You're on the air. Okay, today we're really going to get into these molecules, these 5,000 molecules now that we're past water, and we have all our bonding firmed up. What's that? This we did last time. We ended up a lot of organic nomenclature here so we can understand this abbreviation for writing organic structures. C's at the interstices, vertices, and when there's nothing at the end of a line in this kind of form, it's a hydrogen. We'll get even to further abbreviations about halfway through. So let's take a look at this, what's called the straight chain glucose molecule. This is called a Fischer projection, and these OHs are not arbitrarily assigned to one side or the other. They mean something in terms of three-dimensional space. We're going to be concerned always with three-dimensional space, not this two-dimensional space, because that's real life. It takes place in three dimensions. But it's too complicated to go into right now. After we start talking about proteins, we'll revisit this depiction and what it means in three-dimensional space. But we're going to talk about three-dimensional space in just a few minutes in another way. This is a complicated, important slide, which is also a handout, 2.7, illustrates what's happening to this glucose molecule, this straight chain. It happens to be that if you have a functional group which is a ketone or an aldehyde, in this case an aldehyde, that is a carbonyl group, which is the superset of aldehydes and ketones, C double bond O is a carbonyl. That's a functional group. These are reactive groups. And they can undergo a reaction if they would bump into, in this solution, an OH group. They can undergo a reaction which changes the configuration of the atoms around them. This is a chemical reaction. Almost all of those arrows in intermediary metabolism, I mean all of those arrows, represent chemical reactions. And not only chemical reactions, but they represent, in addition, the presence of a catalyst to speed up these kinds of chemical reactions. And we'll go into this more when we talk about the action of catalysts in detail. But in this case, one of the major jobs of a catalyst is to put the two reacting groups close together so that their electron clouds can mesh and they can come out in a different configuration. In this reaction I'm going to talk about right now, the reactive groups are on the same molecule. It's an intramolecular reaction. And so we don't need a catalyst. These guys are bumping into each other for force all the time, right? Because they're right next to each other. And this molecule is dancing, remember, not only translationally, but also vibrationally in here and swinging around these single bonds. You have free rotation about single bonds. So this guy can be swinging around this number two position. And these are not actually in a straight line, but are kind of bent. We'll see all that in the future too. So, if we follow on the right side of this handout, this ring formation, is that this C double bond O is going to be, let's say, attacked, you might say, by this oxygen with this big arrow. It's going to attack this double bond and form an oxygen carbon bond. So it's going to be carbon, oxygen, carbon. This double bond is going to split open. One of its bonds is now devoted to carbon 5's oxygen. And this hydrogen, previously present, is kicked off and ends up on the carbon 1 oxygen. So carbon 1 now, which had a carbonyl in the ring form, now has a hydroxyl. And carbon 1, which was in this carbonyl, is now formed a ring that goes through and oxygen. So we didn't really have to draw these C's in here because of our known abbreviation, or these H's, but we've done it here because it is a complicated thing. Right? So we have a six-membered ring which has an oxygen as one of the members of the ring and four carbons. And you'll notice one carbon now is left out of this ring, which is carbon 6, and it's left hanging off. So for this reaction to take place, these have to be able to bump into each other. You couldn't do it, let's say, with this number 2 oxygen that's on this hydroxyl, because it's just too close and can't reach over here. Same with number 3. And number 4 actually could do it. It could do it. But number 5 can do it more easily. If number 4 does it, there's a little bit of strain in the smaller ring. But as we'll see in a few minutes, that such rings can form. And 6 is just too far away and forms sort of an unfavorable angles for all these bonds. So the favored reaction is with carbon 1 and carbon 5. Now, it gets more complicated, because depending on which side of this double bond this oxygen attacks in all this intramolecular gyrations, if it comes in from one side, the resulting hydroxyl on carbon 1 is going to be in this ring, is going to be in a certain orientation relative to the ring. Whereas if it comes in on the other side of the bond, then the hydroxyl is going to be in the other orientation. So you can see the difference. Here it's below the ring, and here it's above the ring. This is called a Haworth projection or Haworth view, and is what you see in your text mostly. But this is not an accurate depiction of the three-dimensional structure of this molecule, and we're going to be very interested in the three-dimensional structure and the consequences, and in general, as we go through the next weeks, the consequences, the effect of structure on function. And our first lesson in that has started. So the reason people write this Haworth projection, which is inaccurate in terms of three dimensions, is because it's easier to write. It's still not so easy to write. You have all these groups, and you have to make this hexagon, and you have to keep, say, the oxygen by convention over here in the upper right. But if you look over here where we're going, you see it's a lot simpler. Now let me say one more thing. This carbon, which is a special carbon because it's attached to the carbonyl and is reactive, is called the anomeric carbon. It's just a term. Right? And these two different forms that result from the reactivity of the reaction of this anomeric carbon in these two different ways in space are called anomers. So we have, and we give one a name, alpha and beta. You know, could have named them 1 and 2, or Roman numeral 1, Roman numeral 2, or A and B. But they've been called alpha and beta. So in biology and many other places, alpha and beta are just context dependent and just indicate two different forms. Let's take a look at that reaction. Is this dark enough? Should I dim the lights? How many say dim the lights? How many say leave it like it is? I'll leave it like it is. Okay. So here's our straight chain, and this is a little broken up animation. Now it's starting, say, to dance from its, I'm going to go back and forth here, starting out vertical, and now it's starting to bend over, and you can start to see some of these angles a little bit. You have to imagine some of these atoms are coming out towards you, and some of them are going behind the screen. Now it's prostrate here. Now it starts to move again, and now it's starting to get into a serious situation where this CHO, which is now abbreviated for CHC double bond O, is getting pretty close to this carbon 5. Now the numbers aren't on here, but you just have to keep renumbering. Remember the CHO being have the less hydrogens is number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and this one is 6. So this one gets close. And even better positioned, it's finally going to attack. Well, that go by too fast. It's going to attack. It's attacking on this side, I believe. Yes. I'm going back and forth. This side, and this hydrogen is coming up and joining up here. Right? Let's do it in color. So we have our hydrogen, our attack over here. And you can see this hydrogen is going to end up on this oxygen. So now the gold and the red are connected. It's coming in from the left. And the result is the OH is now above the ring as depicted in this Haworth projection, which is the only thing we know so far. But we're going to get into the real three-dimensional structure in a minute. Up. Ring formation up. Coming from the left, ring formation up. Okay. So if we look over here in our two, the one where it's up here, well, that's the beta. So this created the beta. So now we know that this is beta. Let's try it again. Goes through. It knows its steps in this case. Of course, this is all random motion in reality. Get close. Now we're already in color. Now, however, the purple arrow is attacking the right side of the double bond, the other side of the double bond. And the result is now the new hydroxyl that's formed is oriented down. And now if we look over here, we see the down position. And down here and up is just relative. The way to think about it, it's relative to the other guy. It's relative to the hydrogen. So in this case, down means down compared to the hydrogen. In this case, up means up compared to the hydrogen. It doesn't mean up or down compared to the ring, even though it looks like it. So we have our two forms, our two enomers, beta-glucose and alpha-glucose. In this case, they're both called glucose. And indeed, this reaction is reversible. So after another few minutes, you might have the ring opening and back to the straight chain. And then the straight chain will close again, and maybe a beta will become alpha. So the whole reaction here goes to some equilibrium, which has then three products or reactants. They're both. The straight chain, the alpha glucose, and the beta glucose. Although I say in my notes they're roughly equal, actually the beta is the winner here by some modest amount. So you have beta, most. You have alpha, next most. And the least frequent form you'll find at any given snapshot in time will be the straight chain. So the rings are more stable, and that's why you see them. And these will happen with just glucose put into a glass of water. It doesn't require any catalyst because the molecule is reacting with itself. In general, if you have two molecules that have the same overall formula, C6H12O6, but they have a different structure in space or a different arrangement of atoms, they're called isomers. This is an overall term. These are special kinds of isomers that are isomers only in 3D structure. So they're called stereoisomers. So beta and alpha glucose are stereoisomers of each other. Now, you'll notice none of these other hydroxyls are changing. They're not undergoing any of this ring-closing reactions. And they always come out the same. And that's because in the straight chain, they were also in particular positions relative to this, what's really a bent molecule that's going in and out of the in front of and behind the screen. So when it folds up, there's only one way. This is a little hard to accept. If I had a molecular model, we'd see it. If you have organic chemical kits, you can do this. And you'll see every time you make this ring, these hydroxyls always go to the same place. In glucose, it happens to be that they're all... let me hold that. So those don't change. And they're fixed for a molecule called GLUCOS. If it was there's other sugars, also have the formula C6H12O6, like mannose and galactose, and we'll see those in a minute. And they have different arrangements of those OHs and Hs around those carbons. And they are indeed also stereoisomers of glucose. These, in addition to being isomers, and stereoisomers in particular, they are anomers in even more particular, because they're formed via this anomeric carbon, and they're dynamic in terms of their formation and dissolution. Here's some different views of that may or may not help. From the side, now you can see this ring that it's not a flat ring, that it has a lot of bends in it. Okay, so let's jump into this three-dimensional, real three-dimensional shape now. Because these bonds are all not straight and neat like this, but bent, the structure of glucose really looks more like this. So you can imagine taking this six-membered ring and bending one end down and the other end up, and you end up in something that looks sort of like a chair, and that's what it's called, a chair conformation. It's really more like, it's not so straight, this is not so severe, more like a chaise lounge. But, and that's only one way to bend it. We could have bent it the other way so that this was the toe of the chair, or the footrest, right? And this was the headrest. Or we could have bent it in such a way that the two ends are both up, in which case it's not a chair anymore, but it's a boat. And I don't show you the boat. Or the other chair, because although the glucose molecule can flip among these three possibilities, the chair with one end up, that is the carbon one up, or the carbon one down, right, relative to the other end, and when they're both up, or down if you capsize the boat, then these are less stable. So the ones I'm showing you are the predominant molecules by far in solution. Okay, let's take a closer look at this three-dimensional structure, and let's look at it in general up here for any sugar. This is a hexose, so sugars can be prefixed as to how many carbons they have. So glucose is a hexose, and there's also pentoses and septoses and trioses. So hexoses form this ring, and it has this chair-like conformation. And what's happened now to these atoms that are hanging off the carbons that are not involved in the ring itself? Let's take number four, for example, first. So number four is over here, and it's on the right. And after we've folded it, closed it into a ring, it is below in the Haworth conformation. So the one that's below, so here it would be E, right? Because it's below the other guy, which I told you is the only thing information you get here, is that this OH is below this H. So this E is below this A. And if you look at the real conformation now, maybe a little hard to see here, but I think you can see, is that the A is definitely sticking up, right? And the other guy is not sticking down, but is sticking out. So this guy, A guy, is going parallel to the axis going through the middle of this ring. That's why it's called A, right? And the other one, that's below A in this projection, is not really below the ring, but is sticking out along the equator of this ring, and that's why it's called E. So we have an axial positioning, and we have an equatorial positioning. And if we go around, say, to the carbon 3, we see that the top guy was axial and up, right? Really up now, we're talking about a three-dimensional space. We go to number 3, which also has a hydroxyl and a hydrogen. We see the up guy is what? Up relative to the other guy is now equatorial. Over here it was the one that was lower was equatorial. Here it's the one that's higher relative to these two people here is now equatorial. And it just alternates as you go along. Now the equatorial is the lower one. Here the equatorial is the higher one. And now we see there's another axial, different. It's still these are both axial, but this one, if we want to talk about it, this one is axial up. This one is axial, but down. So we have three possibilities for these bonds. They can be either axial up, axial down, or equatorial. And that gives us the picture then of this molecule in three-dimensional space. Now let's go back over to our newly formed structure, which is the enomeric carbon, which is carbon 1 in glucose. And here we see that from the alpha glucose, which is over here, we have the hydroxyl is actually down, axial down. It's below over here and axial down. Well, that's okay. These kind of agree. In beta, however, this one, which looks like it's up, is actually out. It's equatorial and out, right? Well, equatorial is always out. There is no equatorial in because this whole center of the ring is just filled with the electron clouds of all this. There's no room in here. Okay, so now we have some feeling for, in this chair view, they're hard to write, and you don't see them in books too much, but I think they're very important because they help us right away learn a lesson about structure and function, which we're now 25% through. So it's unfortunate, in a way. I always debate starting with glucose and polysaccharides. I'd like to get polysaccharides sort of first out of the way. They're kind of simple in terms of polymers, but their components are actually rather complicated. So this is going to be one of the most complicated molecules, monomers, small molecules you're going to meet in which you consider the structure. So it's sort of trial by fire right away. This may or may not help. It took me a while to figure this out. Here's the red is oxygen. It's carbon, rather. Well, no, what is it? It's oxygen. See, I'm having trouble. This greenish-gray, there's the vertex, right? So that's the carbon. What's this? Oh, that's got to be carbon what?
Six,
the one that hangs off. So we forget about him for a while. And now we see the carbon. The red must be oxygen. And then this the steel gray here is hydrogen. So you can see this guy seems to be down. These are sort of out. This, is it down or is it out? Well, this one looks more up, the hydrogen. Right? So this must be out. Indeed, this looks like, and is, alpha glucose, because only one of them is really down relative to the ring, and the others are sticking out equatorially. One way to think about equatorial is that these big hydroxyls, the oxygen is sort of as big as carbon here, are just getting out of the way and sticking out here. And that's why this particular chair conformation, for instance, is favored, is it maximizes the number of equatorially located hydroxyl groups. But this is now like a little too much organic chemistry. This is a blow-up. I guess I had planned to use this for what I just said, because it's bigger. So we have these two enemers. This is again on your handout. I'll try to spend only 15 seconds on it because I've already said all this. But what this handout gives you, in case it's confusing to you, which it should be for about 60% of you, this difference between the flat ring view, which is shown in all the books, sometimes they agree and sometimes they don't. What's carbon 1 up, but carbon 1 could be out. This looks like it's down, but it's really out. So I'll let you gaze at that at your leisure after you go home. Here's a space-filling model for that glucose, so you can see there's no room inside. And it's a very compact molecule. It's only 3 times the diameter of water, 1.5 angstroms. These are hard to look at, but if you sit and you think about it, you can sort of figure it out. First of all, here's the ring. So you see the grays must be carbon. In fact, there is a legend here. Gray is carbon. The white, which is here, is hydrogen. And the red is oxygen. So you can see here's the ring. And how can we orient ourselves? Well, there's one big oxygen attached to a carbon, which is sort of not part of this ring. So that's got to be carbon 6. Carbon 6 is thing to look for to start orienting yourself as to where we are in the molecule. It's easiest to find because it's not part of the ring. So here's CH2OH. It should be CH2OH. Where's the other H? It's hiding behind, right? So if only we could turn it over, we'd see it there. How do we know? Because we know it's OH and we don't see it here. So it's got to be behind. So if this is 6, then either this could be 5 or this could be 5. But here's the ring, and there's an oxygen. So we know the oxygen is between carbon 1 and carbon 5, if we can remember back that far. So it must be that this is 5. You go across the oxygen, this is 1. Right. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's a hydroxyl group, there's the ring oxygen. So you can get to sort of familiarize yourself. So a nice little puzzle would be, is this alpha or is this beta? And you can figure it out. Took me about 90 seconds. I'll leave that for you. Here's on my back a picture where I'm so enamored of the glucose molecule, you can see I've got this tattoo. If you Google chair and glucose, you get some funny things. This seems like beta because it's just sort of like flat, everything is symmetrical, it's like all the groups are out. Whereas this looks more like alpha, where this guy could be hanging down, if you turn this cup on its side. And I guess I got ahead of myself because this was supposed to segue me into the flipping between the boat and the two chairs, right? So I already talked about that. Okay, so that's the glucose molecule. There's plenty of problems on glucose and other sugars that relate to everything I just said about where the hydroxyls are, so that you're going to get, you're going to become experts on glucose rings. Something you will learn now, and you'll get again in organic chemistry if you're not already taking organic chemistry, or if you haven't. And then 2 years from now, you'll forget. But you'll remember the point, maybe, we get to finally in the end, which I haven't gotten to yet. And I can't get to it until we start building the real polysaccharides. So we're going to make a polymer just from glucose. It's very simple. Glucose, glucose, glucose. Glucose is the monomer. That's all you find is glucose in the polymer. And we could, say, start with alpha glucose or beta glucose, or, say, a mixture. So let's see what happens. First, let's see how these two molecules can be connected. All the polymers we'll talk about are connected the same way. There's a reaction in which a water molecule is produced by the joining of these two molecules. And therefore, these kinds of reactions are called dehydrations. Since we're condensing two molecules into one, they're also called condensations. And we can, not all condensations would be dehydrations, but for biological polymers, they are. So let's look at the formation of a dimer to begin with. If we have two groups and they're reactive enough, in the case of sugars, it's the enomeric carbon. One of these partners has to be the enomeric carbon because it's the only one that's reactive. And it's because it's distinctive, because that hydroxyl is bound to a carbon that's also bound to an oxygen, and that makes it more reactive. I won't tell you why. I'm not sure I remember why. But it has to do with the electrons and whatever. But so the enomeric carbon has to be one. The other one could be any hydroxyl, the other partner. But here we're talking about building a polymer from any two monomers. It could be amino acids or, maybe not amino acids. Any two sugars. So here's the water that's going to come out. H donated by one and OH by the other. And now we have two molecules in solution that have to get together for this to happen. And so it's not one of these intramolecular reactions, but these kinds of reactions, and 99.9% of the reactions in the cell are going to require a catalyst. And what that catalyst is, we will defer because we haven't talked about catalysts yet, but we will. So you have to accept there's a catalyst that is critical for allowing this reaction and to take place and causing it to take place in real time. So the product then is not just water, but now this oxygen is now bound to this right-hand R group, and you have a ROR. And if these R's are sugars, this is called a glycosidic bond. In general, you look sort of like an ether bond if you've had a little organic chemistry. But if they're sugars, they're called glycosidic bonds. Because one of those carbons has an oxygen connected to it also. I said this. As long as we're considering the formation of the polymer, let's consider the reverse reaction. So rather than a dehydration, it's kind of a hydration, right? But the word used is hydrolysis. Lysis means breaking, and hydro is for water. So it's water used to break a bond. This also requires a catalyst. And it's just now starting with the dimer here, adding water across one of these bonds to form ROH and ROH. Dimer hydrolysis, water has become part of the molecule, water atoms. That requires a different catalyst for the reverse reaction. That's generally true, although not always. Okay, now that we know the, in general what's going to happen, let's build a polymer, and we're going to do it in an organized way. And since we have a catalyst, these catalysts are very specific for their reactants and very specific for the exact reaction that they will catalyze. They are very finicky, and in there lies a lot of the specificity that we need for life. So this catalyst that's going to connect these two is going to start, let's say, with either alpha or beta, but not both. Just one of them is going to recognize either alpha or beta. Let's start with beta. And since I told you one of these reactants for this reaction to occur has to be the anomeric carbon, and that's on carbon 1 in glucose, so that's in red. This guy is in blue to draw attention to it, because what this catalyst is going to do has to join two molecules. It's going to join the carbon 1 of one molecule to the carbon 4 of the other molecule. So we're going to extract water from here. Not the carbon 3 or the carbon 2 or the carbon 6, which also hydroxyls, but it will be specific to remove that. And the result will be now these two chairs connected to each other. Right? I'll continue to use the chairs. Now, what about this dimer, and what about chairs and stuff? Here, we no longer have this hydroxyl here. Now this oxygen is locked into this glycosidic bond. It's probably mentioned here. Yeah. So this ring can no longer open up, because that requires a hydroxyl. Over here, this hydroxyl is still there. So if we waited a few minutes, we might have the free form. Why not? This is just in solution. The catalyst is gone. It did its job. And we have this disaccharide. It has a name, cellobios. A beta glucose attached to another glucose is cellobios through a beta, we can call this linkage a beta glycosidic bond, because this guy's in beta. But this guy could be opening up, could be alpha next time, could be beta next time, doesn't matter. This catalyst requires a beta. So if this guy is going to go on and connect to make a trimer, you're going to have to wait until this is in the beta conformation. Then the catalyst can work on it and form another beta 1,4 linkage. Another glycosidic bond will have 3. And then 4, 5, 6, 1,000. Make something wrong. Just keep repeating the same thing over and over, looking for an end that's beta, connecting it to a free glucose molecule. It could be anything. Because number 4 always looks the same, whether it's alpha or beta. Maybe it has to be the ring. I'm not sure. Said that. Locked in. This guy's not locked in. Now, you'll notice that what's the conformation of the hydroxyl in the chair, three-dimensional conformation, in glucose? All of the carbons except for one, number one, the hydroxyls, they're all in the equatorial position in glucose. That's why it's maybe such a favorite molecule, and that's sort of the stablest thing. Nothing's getting in anybody's way. Right? So this is definitely equatorial anytime you meet it. This guy, because it's beta, is also in the equatorial position. So 1 to 4 goes not only, for one thing, it goes across the molecule, so there's no angle here. As we go from 1 to 2, and if we go to 3, 4, 5, 6, 900, we're going to be kind of in a straight line, because this is sticking out, and this one is sticking out, and they just go right across. And now we're getting into the consequences of this three-dimensional structure. these kinds of glycosidic bonds, if they're projected in the Hayworth projection, this cell abiotic is in the Hayworth projection. What is that? It's got elbows in these bonds? No. The Hayworth projection, again, does not pretend to tell you directly about three-dimensional form. The reason is if this were going to be kind of straight, it would be straighter if this right-hand molecule were turned over upside down. And sometimes you see that in books for cell abiotics. You'll see this one right side up, what I call it, which is the oxygen in the upper right, and this one with the oxygen down here in the lower left. And to avoid these elbows, right? But so this just means this is coming from the upper one here in the Hayworth projection and connecting to the lower one here. So it's giving you the information. And it's up to you then to know what the consequences are in three-dimensional space to imagine or draw these difficult-to-draw chair structures. If, for instance, the other possibility is that we have an enzyme that makes that takes the alpha conformation, which here is beneath the hydrogen, and then we have a straighter nine, still with these elbows, which are not realistic. And so you see, if we straighten out these elbows, this thing would have to swing down, right? So here we have a beta 1,4 on cell abiotics. If an alpha is used, and this one we don't care. The left-hand one is alpha, then we have an alpha 1,4. And two glucoses together form a disaccharide. The disaccharides, these are common enough disaccharides so that they have a name, and this one's called maltose. So maltose and cell abiotics have different English names. They're not called like alpha glucose, beta glucose, they're very similar. These have completely different names except for the os, which means a sugar. Said that. But you can look at it later if you want. Okay, now let's draw those not in the Hayworth projection, let's draw these disaccharides in the chair conformation. Let's look at the cell abiotics first. So cell abiotics connected across straight, and the consequence if we go on from that and extend this, make this polymer, and I have this very accurate molecular model here from Tinker Toys. So we can consider that bond that's going to form to the next molecule of glucose and form that beta as being sort of in a straight line. So now the next one also straight, and the next one also straight. So we make kind of this long, straightish kind of molecule. There it is. That's this one, right? Okay, now we're in solution, and the catalyst is plenty of the catalyst there, and so it finds another glucose to start yet another molecule and adds glucose to it, and now we have another tetramer of beta 1,4 linked glucose. Not cell abiotics anymore, cell abiotics is the name for the dimer, so this is just a tetramer of glucose in beta 1,4 linkages, and these guys are floating around, right? Now, is there any way we could connect these two? I suppose they bump into each other. What could hold them together, right? There's no more catalyst that's going to make, there's no more reactive carbons. The anomer has been used up to form these bonds. What's left are all these hydroxyls sticking out. Well, what can they do? They can form these weak hydrogen bonds, right? So hydroxyl can form a weak hydrogen bond. So there'll be a little bond here. Next minute it's gone, and find some other partner, find some water, right? Plenty of water around. Next minute binds here, next minute binds here. Suppose these two bind, stays a little longer, right? Then comes apart. And how about, suppose it just went like this. And this one goes away, but this one's still holding, right? And this is right next to it now, so it'll form again, the preferred partner, almost like that cage business. It's already right there, so it's going to form a carbon with that. So these two fours, they probably won't stick together anymore. But suppose these were 1,000 long. They get together. They'll never get them apart, because as soon as one comes apart, you still have like 900. 100 come apart. The other 900 is still holding at that moment. So all these strands, these long strands now, single strands, end up associating. And you get not cell abiotics, but cellulose. So you can consider cellulose as a single polymer. That's also cellulose, a single polymer molecule. And the same word could be used for the cellulose that we know and use popularly. Here's a picture from the crystal structure of cellulose, which is where all the atoms have been, in fact, located in space. And you'll see that actually most of the hydrogen bonding is between, as I've outlined here, involves hanging off carbon 6, which is reasonable. It was sort of like the scouting party for this molecule. It's hanging out. That's going to be the first guy to reach another molecule. And you have then one for every molecule. So it's sometimes this guy's 6, and the next one, in fact, will be the other guy's 6. You have CH2 hanging off. And also going to carbon, what is this? 0, 1, 2, 3. 6 to 3. That's what they found. You could maybe have predicted it. That's what they found in the crystal structure of a cellulose fiber. So you get a fiber. Suppose we do the same thing with now maltose and start to grow it. Here we have a molecule is again going to be 1,4 and a different catalyst that will take now alpha glucose and work on that. Use that reactive enomeric carbon hydroxyl and connect it to again a 4 from the other one. Didn't have to be, but this is what the catalyst is looking for. This is what nature has selected. Now, unlike this case, as you go from the left member of this disaccharide to the right-hand member, we have this severe angle. It's not maybe as severe as this looks, but it's still pretty. It's not straight, that's for sure. Number 4, you remember, is always out. That's carbon 4's hydroxyl. And in alpha glucose, the hydroxyl is always down, if we say alpha. So once you form that bond and locked it in, you form this angle. Let's go back to our monomers. And let's work with a severe angle for dramatic license here. So we make our first now the opposite of straight. We make this angle. Right? And now we add the next one, so it's also going to be at an angle. Right? It could be. We have rotation here. I'll do it like this. Now we add the next one, getting in the way a little bit. And we add the next one, always at an angle. Now I can't do this, so I have to displace them a little. Actually, I could do it like this. So we have no problem. And I'll just add all the ones I have. I've hydrolyzed the wrong way. Okay, so there's my octamer of polyalpha glucose, right? So I could arrange this, since we have free rotation, like that, right? But look at all these molecules now. Look at all these atoms, right? In this one molecule. So they're looking around. They're interacting with water, but now they find a partner who is right there in the same molecule, right, to form, let's say, hydrogen bonds with, right? And this guy could form hydrogen bonds here, and this guy could form hydrogen bonds here. And so once they start to form this structure, and indeed, when you have molecules like this that the monomers have the ability to interact with each other, in this case by hydrogen bonding, as soon as you have an angle and start to turn, you have the possibility of making an intramolecular structure, quite different from the case for cellulose. Cellulose couldn't do that. It's all splayed out, stretched, straight. It has to look for an outside partner. Here we have the possibility of an inside partner, even easier. Everything's right there in this, whereas the other poly-alpha glucose molecules are far away. You have to wait for them to collide with you. So you take advantage of that. And the result is you keep adding and you just keep forming this big helical structure. And that will be the tendency of a polymer to form a helix if it can interact with itself and if there is some angle in the bond. And in this case, this width is quite high because the angle is not as severe as I made it here. This is a helix of polyalpha-1,4 glucose. It's just a helix, right? It's not, doesn't have any particular name. If we have to give it a name, let's give a name to this whole molecule after it's formed all these bonds, say 1,000 long or more, and that's the structure of starch. Okay, so that's another polysaccharide we're familiar with. Right? So we can call it the starch helix. It's not the double helix. It's not the alpha helix. These have specific names, specific other roles. This is just a helix and starch. It gets more complicated in this case. Here we have part of this helix on the left. How many want the lights down now? Okay, we're okay. So you don't have to see the details here. Well, you do have to see some details. So going along here, we have always a carbon 6 hanging off. And there's a second catalyst. And we'll take this the first catalyst, just put two glucoses together using the carbon 1 in the alpha conformation and the carbon 4. Carbon 1, carbon 4, carbon 1, carbon 4. After we get a certain length, there's another catalyst that's looking for carbon 6. It looks for carbon 6 in this structure and again attaches it to carbon 1. Carbon 1, because one of them has to be to form the glycosidic bond anomeric. This is not anomeric carbon, not too reactive, but carbon 1 hydroxyl is anomeric. So we can bring in a carbon 1 here from another glucose molecule, or another maltose molecule even. So this is 1,4,1,4,1,4, and now we have a 6,1 over here, a 6,1. And we're left with a 4 unmated here for the moment. And you can see I've already brought in now the first catalyst is looking for a 4, accepts this 4 perfectly well, doesn't care about all this stuff down here, and starts to build another molecule, 4-1, 4-1, 4-1. What's the difference between 4-1 and 1-4? There's no difference. It's just a matter of how we speak it. So we have made a branch exploiting or using this 6 carbon and connecting that, and we have to use a 1. Right? So now we have this bifurcation. And this continues, this process continues, called branching, so that these thick gray lines now represent this helical structure of starch in 1,4s, and every once in a while there'll be a branch that comes off, and so now you have this whole tree of polyglucose. So the function of this polyglucose, which is now called starch, is to store glucose for when times get tough and you've used up all the energy in that Snickers bar. You form something like starch. Animals form a very similar molecule to this, and it's called glycogen. You can form it in your muscles. You can form it in your liver. And so this grows and grows and grows until it's a big glycogen granule inside these cells. Now, when times are tough, you can go and start the reverse reaction, bring in a third catalyst now, and start hydrolyzing these glucoses and make them available for energy, which we'll learn about how glucose is used for energy later on. Here's a picture of some kind of probably a mammalian cell of some kind, maybe human. And these are these starch. This is a nucleus, by the way, right? And this is cytoplasm over here. And here's some of those organelles. This is an actual picture. This is an electron micrograph. And this is filled with these starch granules that are storing all this glucose when times are tough. So that's our lesson for how this simple, not simple, but this one change in the orientation of an oxygen around one carbon in a monomer. You build a polymer and you get, in one case, a fiber with great tensile strength. You can make shirts out of it. It's cotton. Right? In another case, you get this soft stuff which can be used as a source of energy. You can eat it, like a baked potato. How often these branches occur, that's the difference between the average frequency, is the difference between cornstarch and potato starch. Right? In glycogen, they're even more closely spaced than in vegetable starches. And the result for glycogen is you have all these ends finally in this granule. You know, you have thousands of these ends, and so you can easily then attack those ends and start. And it's all compact because we want to move around. The plants don't care. We want to move around. We don't want these big voluminous structures. So we make it very compact. We can only see the outside of this ball, but we can start attacking, and we make lots of branches so that we have lots of surface to work with and utilize that glucose. Utilize that glycogen to release glucose. So when I go running, I run for about 2-3 minutes, maybe 4 minutes. I say, oh, wait, starting to run, jogging, right? I say, oh, not going to make it today, boy. I'm not going to make it today. I'm just exhausted, you know. As a sign, I must have not gotten enough sleep. You know, I used to say that anyway until I learned this stuff, right? And then it gets a little better. And pretty soon I'm running along, you know, no problem, right? No problem. I could run for minutes. And that's because I ran out of the glucose that's coursing through my veins. And I had to start breaking down the glycogen. So start getting the signal, hey, we need more energy. Let's break down that glycogen in my muscles first, right? And the muscle cells are using that glucose to power me along. Okay. So, structure goes hand in hand with function. This is a relatively, it's a simple example from the point of view of the polymer. The polymers get much more complicated. But I have to admit, for the monomer, this is about the most complicated monomer we're going to have. What about other carbohydrates? So we're back to a more descriptive mode here. Look at this guy, fructose. I mean, just some examples. There aren't all that many different sugars, right? Maybe a dozen. Fructose. What about this? Look at this. Where's the N-omer carbon? There it is. It's carbon. Wait a minute. I said number one is the least hydrogens around it, but that's over here. We can have one here, and then 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and what will we call this? Well, that's silly, right? Let's just call this end of the molecule that is a neighbor to this guy is number one. So this is still number one at the top because this end of the molecule has the least hydrogens. It's the most oxidized in more rigorous terms. So here's one, here's two. So it's carbon two that is the N-omer carbon here. So when this forms a ring, it's going to, you might think it would go to six, but it doesn't. It goes, in fact, again to five. And as a result, we have only four carbons, well, 2, 3, 4, 5, only four carbons, 2, 3, 4, 5. And we make a five-membered ring, which I warned you is possible without too much strain. So you have a five-membered ring, one member of which is oxygen, and now in addition to carbon 6 hanging off, we also have carbon 1 hanging off. And there's the ring form of fructose. Right? So fructose is mostly an intermediate, actually, in the metabolism of glucose, unless you eat high fructose corn syrup. The corn syrup I mentioned in lecture 1 is just pure corn syrup, which is just pure glucose. Here's alpha. Here's another way of forming that ring, which is even more simplistic than the Haworth projection. You see it sometimes in some books. Not all sugars have six carbons. Here's a very important and abundant sugar in our cells, of which we make polymers, polymers like DNA and RNA. And they have a five-membered sugar. In this case, for RNA, it's ribose. And this has a structure very similar to glucose. Carbon 1 has the N-omer carbon, and it can form, again, a five-membered ring, and the carbon 6 is going to be hanging off. So the So, but there's only five carbons, so it only has one hanging off. Ribose is called a pentose instead of a hexose. That makes sense. Talked about that already. Now let's consider other hexoses that, and their three-dimensional structure, but rather than draw these hard chairs, and understanding the difference, we'll look at the Hayworth projections. So here's glucose. Sometimes it's called glucopyranose, just a fancier name for the same thing. And sometimes, and here's the alpha, because it's been drawn with the hydroxyl below the hydrogen. And then it's called D for reasons we'll get into later that has to do with the arrangement of the hydroxyls around this relative to each other. How about galactose? So galactose is a sugar that you can get from milk. And you see it's very similar to glucose, except, all right, so this one doesn't really count, right? This is beta, right? So we on the carbon 1, it's in purple here. This enamer is shown in the beta configuration, but we know if we wait a few minutes, we'll find it in the alpha configuration if it's just in water. The rest of the molecule is locked in, except over here at the number 4 position, instead of this hydroxyl being down, and if you remember, if you memorized it, that all and glucose, all except for this one which we don't know about at carbon 1, all the others are sticking out equatorial. That must mean then that this one's in the opposite conformation, so this must be sticking up, axial up. Right? So rather than call it, you know, glucose A and glucose B and glucose C, it's been given just a completely different name. But these two are just stereoisomers of each other. They're the same arrangements of carbons and hydroxyls and hydrogens, all the same, but they're arranged differently in three-dimensional space. And it's most clearly seen after the ring forms. This guy is forced to go up, whereas this guy is always out in glucose. So glucose and galactose. And we could do it for some other carbon. You find mannose, also found in some foodstuffs. And in our cells, we make mannose for some purposes. At carbon 2. And carbon 2 is now opposite if you look at glucose. We always take glucose, say, as our reference. And then we have allose, which has, I left that for you to figure out which one is different. It's easy. Just look at it. What's different about this picture? So, sometimes, on the other hand, we have a completely different formula, like instead of C6H12O6 and ribose, we would have C5H12O5, and then there's C5H10O5. What could that be? That's that has an OH substituted by an H. I don't know if this doesn't appear to me to be right, but in any case, deoxyribose, just what it says, one oxygen is missing. Take out that oxygen and put the hydrogen up there, so one part around the ring is missing a hydroxyl, and that's what's used in DNA. Here's a couple of disaccharides we meet in our daily life. Lactose, which is a sugar found in milk. It's a disaccharide, not between two glucoses, but between glucose and galactose. It's just a disaccharide, stops there. And to get energy from milk, you have to hydrolyze that bond. You have a catalyst for that. Most of us do. Some of us, as we get older, don't, and we have lactose intolerance. So so this is actually in a beta linkage, but that's not important for that. This point is milk sugar. Sucrose, which is table sugar or cane sugar, is fructose and glucose connected between the 1 and the 2. The 2 carbon of fructose is the enomeric, and it's attached to the 1 carbon of glucose. Now, the 1 carbon of glucose is also enomeric. So there's no law against that. It doesn't have to be. You only need one part to be enomeric. But these two guys sort of use up both their enomeric carbons connecting to each other. As a result, they have no anomeric carbon left and cannot go on, actually, to do anything. So this is an obligatory disaccharide. And we split that bond, we get fructose and glucose, we can use both of those for energy. Indeed, I looked this up just last night because there's a lot of interest in high and advertisements and both ways about high fructose corn syrup. High fructose corn syrup, it turns out, is they take corn syrup, it's just glucose, and they add some catalyst and change about half the glucose into fructose. So there's a rearrangement of the atoms. They're both hexoses. And so you end up with about 50% of each, maybe 40, 60. So that's this high fructose corn syrup that everybody decries. But if you take sucrose and you eat it, it's just table sugar, and you break it down, what do you get? 50% fructose, 50% glucose, the same. So I really don't understand what's the big deal. I think the big deal is you eat too much of it, not the intrinsic quality of high fructose corn syrup, my opinion. You just can't keep eating it. And they keep putting it in things, and you don't know you're eating it, so that's bad. Things get more complicated. You can have amino groups attached to sugars. This is beta-glucose with an amine instead of hydroxyl, called, logically, glucosamine. You could have galactosamine. These kinds of things are used mainly in structural roles, as is cellulose in structural roles. Cellulose contributes to also to the stems, or even to a large degree, although it's not the only thing in trees. It gives the trunk its rigidity. There are additional things. And there's so many plants in the world that cellulose, actually, if you counted all the carbon atoms in all the living things in the world, half of them would be in cellulose. Here, the bacterial cell wall, which is another rigid thing, we said to protect it from the environment, has monomers like this. Here's fructose, this five-membered ring, where the carbon 6 and the carbon 1 have been added to the hydroxyl, added a phosphate group, which we'll talk about a little more later. So this is fructose 1,6 diphosphate or bisphosphate, it's the same. And this is an intermediate in the breakdown of glucose, which we'll see. Here's chitin, which is the exoskeleton of insects. That's, again, sort of a macro version of the cell wall of the bacteria to protect it. Don't have bones inside. They protect it from the outside. And we get even more complicated structures. Here's an amino group, like as we saw over here. Glucosamine, and then the amine has been reacted with this CH3CO, which is like from vinegar, acetic acid, and it's made an amide out of it. Right? So these are those functional groups. So this is acetylaminoglucose. And here's just a glucose. Oh no, actually it's acetyl. I've got it right up here. And acetyl. So to identify where this acetyl group is, it's on the only end that's here. So this is just a homogeneous same monomer over and over again, monotonous polymer. Whereas you might have glucosamine, galactosamine, you could have two different alternating ones. Or you could even have three. Galactosamine, glucosamine, glucose. But that's about it. Polysaccharides tend to be monotonous. They have these embellishments, but you get the same pattern over and over again. And it's just, in this case, if you had three different monomers, you would have three different catalysts that are always looking to put its particular monomer onto something that's come before in a very regular way. So you get the same pattern, ABC, 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 ABC. Because most of these are used either for storing energy, as in glycogen and starch, or more generally for structural purposes. Said all this. Okay. So we have 13 minutes now to go on to lipids and beyond. That's it for the polysaccharides. Let's take our second category of macromolecules, lipids. Lipids is a weird category, because they're not such macromolecules, but we throw them in there because we don't know what else to do with them. In fact, they are defined not in the basis of their structure so much, but rather operationally. That if you break open our E. coli cells and let everything come out, and you grind it up, put it in that blender, or sonicate it, even break it into smaller pieces, and then to this aqueous solution you would add an equal volume of octane, you get these two phases. So most of all the material that was polar in the cell, like glucose or cellulose, if it were a plant, right, would stay in the aqueous phase. But some molecules would tend to be more soluble in the organic solvent, in this case, for illustration, octane, the gasoline, than they are in the aqueous phase. These membrane fragments, they would just love to go in there. What are these? These are things like the octane molecule that are very hydrophobic. They don't like it to be in water. They have no particular reason to be in the water. And so by hydrophobic forces, they will be thrown into the organic phase. So those molecules that are extracted into an organic solvent like octane or benzene or hexane, these are the lipids. And so they're a heterogeneous class of structures, and they're not very much like polymers. Let's take some examples. Here's one extreme example, and I start with it so that we can get our second level of abbreviation down for organic chemistry. So look how stark that looks in terms of the structures we've been looking at. Where is everything? Well, before we said carbon is very common. So whenever we have a vertex in glucose, we said it's going to be a carbon. Okay, we've accepted that by now. Now we say in addition, we know carbon always takes four bonds in all these structures. Except for very unusual situations, carbon takes four bonds. We know this. So why bother putting them in? Well, we have to know what it's attached to. Well, usually it's hydrogens are most common. We already saw that in the previous abbreviation. We put nothing there, it meant hydrogen. So if we know there's four bonds, and very often it's hydrogen, if we say nothing, if we draw nothing, that's the situation. If we draw nothing, this is a carbon. We put no letter here. And since it has these two bonds that are depicted, there must be two other bonds, and they're connected to hydrogen. So that's understood now. So this is a CH2. This is a what? C, 1, 2, 3, one left, H, CH. And here's an OH. It's not. If I just left it blank here, if I just left this blank here, then what would it be? Louder. CH3, right. Because this is sort of a vertex to nowhere, right? So there's an atom there. If I don't say anything, it's got to be carbon. If I don't say anything else, it's got to be hydrogen. So it's a CH3. It's not a hydrogen. But in this case, it's not. It's OH. We write it in. Here we have a double bond between two carbons. And so this carbon, 1, 2, 3, 4, where are the hydrogens? No hydrogens. No hydrogens at all. One hydrogen. Two hydrogens. One hydrogen. Get up here. What's this doing here? We broke our rule. For some reason, maybe this person wanted to talk about this methyl group, didn't have to put the CH3 up here, but they did, here and here. Right? Here's our little house and a TV antenna. What is this antenna? It's just some squiggle. It could be anything, maybe, right? No, this is precisely defined. Here's a CH. Here's a CH3. Here's a CH2, 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 CH, CH3, CH3. Right? So it's a severe abbreviation. But it enables us to write this complicated structure of cholesterol. This is called a steroid. And this four-ring structure or something close to that are called steroids. And this one is cholesterol. It's a very important molecule. We can't live without it. Part of our cell membranes. So steroids have been evolved in various little differences, right? This one doesn't have that antenna, just has an OH instead, so it's more polar at this end and at this end, and the rest is very hydrophobic, right? And that's testosterone. Right? So estrogen is similar, but different, right? Here's cortisone, hydrocortisone, that's used to control metabolism. These are, in general, hormones. So hormones are molecules made in one place, in a multicellular organism's body, and then they have their action somewhere else. They're messengers. So if I'm jogging and my glycogen's breaking down at a decent rate, so give me the energy, and then some big bear's chase starts to appear and I want to run faster, my adrenal glands will secrete this cortisone that will start and go to my muscles and start a signal. You better ramp up this breakdown of glycogen. This guy needs more energy. Vitamin D is a vitamin. Takes part in various chemical reactions. Even though the ring is broken here, it's close enough, so we call it a steroid. And there's our cholesterol. And there's maybe another five or six. That's all for steroids. They're small molecules. They don't form polymers, but they're in this class of lipids. This is a little bit more. This is going to be fats are going to be a little bit more polymeric, and the basic monomer, one of the monomers for fats, is the fatty acid. So we know what this is now: CH3, CH2, CH2, etc., and then COOH, the carboxyl group at the end. That's called a fatty acid. Why is it different from an acid? Well, when this group becomes, if this were acetic acid, we just have a line here, right? CH3, COOH. And then this would be propionic acid, and then, I don't know, butyric acid, pentanoic acid. And eventually they get so long, because it has a large hydrophobic group, then it becomes, it's found in fat, it's called a fatty acid. So at some length, probably around 8, is considered a fatty acid. It has this dual character, a charged group here. It's not shown, but you know it's charged at pH 7, and the rest of it hydrophobic. Okay, this is from your handout 2.9. And we're going to put these now monomers into polymers. And the very first reaction is, again, a dehydration. And I'll take 60 seconds more to show you that dehydration, this got moved. It should be between this OH and this OH. And so we form, forget this circle. We take out one of these OHs. It's going to be the top one, actually. This OH and this OH from this. It's not hydroxyl, it's the OH contributed by the acid part, now drawn backwards. X could be any length, from 8 to 25. You take that out and you form a new bond. Water is produced, not shown. This is a condensation dehydration, and we have formed a new connection. C, from what had been the hydroxyl here, holding the hydroxyl, now connected to what's left of, which is most of it, of the carboxyl. But it's no longer a carboxyl, no longer an acid. There's no hydrogen nucleus to lose, no proton there to lose. It's not an acid. It's not hydroxyl anymore. What is it? It's called an ester, and so yet another functional group. So when you take an acid and an alcohol and you join them together, you get an ester. In this case, because the acid was a carboxylic acid, you could call it more accurately or more precisely a carboxylic acid ester. As we'll see at the beginning of the next lecture, you can form esters with other kinds of acids. And so we have started to build a combination. This guy with three hydroxyls is not quite a sugar because it doesn't have that C double bond O. It's a polyalcohol called glycerol. And we'll pick this up next time as we finish lipids and go on to amino acids.